From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, one man's obsession with what might have been. Dan Gediman couldn't forget that he was almost one of the kids on the 70s hit children's show Zoom. So as an adult, he tracked down the show's former stars to see what he missed. It's a new Life Stories piece by producer Jay Allison and the public radio program This American Life. We'll hear it. Also, what you can learn about people by cleaning their house. We talk with writer and house cleaner Louise Rafkin. Her new book is Other People's Dirt. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews three new CDs featuring clarinetist Ben Goldberg. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. White House counsel Charles Ruff says the White House will appeal a decision compelling presidential confidant and attorney Bruce Lindsay to testify in the Monica Lewinsky investigation. A three-judge appeals panel had ordered Lindsay to testify before a grand jury. The judges rejected arguments that Lindsay's testimony was off limits due to attorney-client privilege. Lindsay is a deputy White House counsel and one of the president's close friends. He has declined to answer several questions in the Lewinsky matter. Counsel Ruff says the White House is seeking an expedited review by the Supreme Court, as well as a delay in the lower court's order for Lindsay to testify. Campaign finance legislation faces critical votes in the House of Representatives this evening. A bipartisan bill that has weathered repeated attacks in recent weeks stands a good chance of being adopted. But NPR's Peter Kenyon reports it still won't be out of the woods.
The bill by Connecticut Republican Christopher Shays and Massachusetts Democrat Martin Meehan would place new restrictions on the virtually unlimited soft money donations that now flood into political party war chests. It would also crack down on what Shays calls sham issue ads and increase financial disclosure requirements for campaigns. Shays says the bipartisan coalition behind the bill has survived relentless attacks, and the fight is now entering the final stages.
Tonight, members of this House will cast one of the most important votes of their careers in this House to help restore integrity to our democratic system of government.
Supporters are trying to generate as big a vote as possible because several alternatives are still out there, and whichever bill gets the biggest margin of support wins. Passage in the Senate is still considered doubtful. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
At least 43 people have been killed and at least 50 more are missing and feared dead due to flooding and landslides in South Korea. This is being described as one of the worst natural disasters ever to afflict the country. Andrew Wood reports from Seoul.
The rains were said to be the heaviest since records began in the modern Republic of South Korea. 10 inches fell on Friday night and Saturday. Thousands of soldiers, police and government officials are still on alert as forecasters have warned of further heavy rain. Most of the deaths were in a national park in the southwest of the country. Many were campers and mountain walkers. They were swept away as they slept. Holidays at home have been particularly popular this year. Korea's economic problems have made foreign vacations too expensive. One rescue worker was killed. Another was badly injured when a helicopter searching for a party of students crashed into a rice field. President Kim Dae-jung has sent messages of condolence. Damage is estimated at more than $50 million. For NPR News, this is Andrew Wood in Seoul.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 12 points at 8,870. The NASDAQ is off 13 at 1859. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market appears to be failing in its efforts to revive after last Friday's big sell-off. Blue chips are showing little reaction to more merger news and a periodic report on the state of the economy. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Wall Street has been trending lower. That is despite the latest Commerce Department report showing Americans' personal incomes rose 0.2% in June. At the same time, personal spending increased by 3 times that amount to 0.6%. There was also word today that supermarket giant Albertsons has agreed to buy rival American Stores for $11.7 billion. The marriage will create the country's biggest grocery and drugstore chain. And the National Association of Purchasing Management reports its key index measuring factory activity fell for the fourth straight month. That was largely due to continuing problems in Asia. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Four TV networks are joining forces to launch a rating service. The move comes as they've become increasingly critical of the way Nielsen Media counts TV viewers. The Wall Street Journal reports CBS, ABC, NBC, and Fox have signed letters of intent to back a new TV rating service nicknamed SMART. It will be run by Statistical Research Incorporated. New York's apple crop is coming in early this year, but experts predict yields may be down as much as 30%. The Syracuse Post-Standard reports El Niño's mild winter and spring is responsible for the earliest apple crop in recent memory. Early apple varieties are being sold in stores right now, but there is a downside. The New York Apple Association reports the mild weather resulted in more insects attacking fruit. They predict New York's largest crop may be down also. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we're going to preview one of the stories from the next edition of the public radio program This American Life. It's called I, Danny, Zoom Revisited, and is produced by Jay Allison as part of his ongoing series, Life Stories. I, Danny, Zoom Revisited is about something that happened, more to the point, something that didn't happen to reporter Dan Gettleman.
This is about a lie. A lie I tell almost to this day, but not after this day. Anyway, I'm Dan Gettleman, Danny, and I was in the first cast of the TV show Zoom.
How are you?
Chances are, Zoom is either something you've never heard of or something you can't forget. And it's probably the only TV show remembered for its address. Zoom was a public TV show for kids in the 70s, produced by WGBH in Boston and aired all over the country. For those of you who never heard of Zoom, here's a little context from television historian David Kleeman.
Zoom was really the first children's television program to put children at center stage, to tell them that their ideas, their works, their creativity was very important. It gave them a chance to submit ideas for the program, to submit artworks, to submit pretty much anything that they thought was important in their lives, and then it might appear on the air. But one interesting thing about Zoom as a generational identifier, it's one of those programs where if you walk up to people who are of that age, who did grow up with Zoom, and say the name, they'll sing the theme song back to you.
Okay, here goes. Come on and zoom, 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 ah, zoom. Come on and zoom, ah, zoom, ah, zoom, ah, zoom. We're gonna
I remembered constantly singing the theme.
People who know it show great enthusiasm. They're willing to do the Bernadette Butterfly thing or risk, you know, singing the zip code.
Boston, Mass. 02134. I still have it.
02134. Send it to Zoom.
It was such a big part of my life, and I remember, the first time I ever saw a kayak was on Zoom.
And I was just dying to be friends with the kids on the show or be one of them.
Oh, come on and zoom, 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 zoom. We're gonna zoom, 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 zoom.
That was as much a playground litany
we're gonna
as
show you the sky.
You know, ring around the rosies for
we're
me
teach to fly
up.
High
we're zoom, 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 zoom.
02134
yeah. 02134 send it to Zoom. You know, I haven't sung that in years.
Come on and zoom, come on and zoom, zoom, come on and zoom. Okay, so suffice it to say, for the purposes of this story at least, Zoom was a big deal. And if you were a cast member of Zoom, you were famous.
Zoom was a given every week, and I don't ever recall watching it with you, though. Now that I think about it, I don't recall ever watching that show with you. Maybe it was too painful. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I watched it. That's my best friend Adam, and he's right. It was painful. I guess I better tell you my lie now. I wasn't really on the first cast of Zoom. I was almost on the first cast of Zoom. They actually cast me, and then they cut me. I can't tell you how horrible this was for a 10-year-old kid, but I guess I can try. That's what I'm doing here. Here's what happened, or at least what I think happened. Memory can protect you from the truth sometimes.
I'm sitting in the dining room of my parents' house talking to my parents about Zoom, and sitting around the dining room table.
To reconstruct my memory, I tried talking to my parents first.
No, I think he told me that he liked certain qualities that you had. One of them was being very forthright.
Here's my dad telling me what he recalls about how I talked to the Zoom producer, Chris Sarson, during the audition process.
But some of the things that you said, whether they ticked him off or not, I don't know, but the two I remember is that you said that they were wearing rugby shirts, and when he asked you, what did you think of the rugby shirts, you said, they suck. Now, that was what? 12, how old were you?
10.
Well, in those days, that was very precocious there. That I don't know. Maybe it was popular then, too. But in any case, I was embarrassed when I heard it. Not because of the word, but just I thought, oh, gee, there goes the farm. And the other one was the name of the show. And apparently you had told this Chris that you thought that Zoom was not a very good idea, that it was kind of corny or one thing or another. And you suggested, I don't know if you gave them another idea, but you suggested they change the name of the show. Those are two things I remember. And
my father apparently remembers me as somewhat of a pain in the ass. And I suspect he's right. I was a bit of a, shall we say, a show-off. I certainly liked attention. I had gotten the Zoom audition in the first place through a Sherlock Holmes skit that my dad, my brother, and I did around the family tape recorder.
Oh, Elms, I'm John the Alfalfa. Don't you remember me?
Of course, yes. I remember you very well from the club. Yes. How are you?
Very fine today. Mm-hmm. And but I have a friend here that would like to meet you. Mr. Watson. Mr. John D. Watson.
I see, of course.
He's right here.
Of course, you neglected to mention that it's Dr. John D. Watson.
Oh, hello, Mr. Elms. I'm Dr. Watson.
Of course you're Dr. Watson.
Yes,
John D. Watson.
It looked like it was all set. I think that I'm sure that I was telling everybody that you were going to be in it, and this was the very beginning of Zoom, so it was going to be the very first group.
Do you recall at all my excitement about this? Or I remember being in the kitchen right around where the sink is, and it was at night. And I was having a little fantasy in my head about what type of house to buy you. Okay?
Wow.
What type of house I would buy you with the, in my mind, the millions of dollars or that were going to be coming in from doing this show. I was sort of imagining, you know, different styles of houses, and you were going to be so proud of me because I was going to move you into this house like Elvis did with his parents.
So this wasn't just a case of me wanting to be famous. I wanted the money, too. I thought I was going to be like Jodie Foster or Johnny Whitaker from A Family Affair. My dad had been laid off from his engineering job, and our family was coming out of some pretty hard times in the early 70s, or at least it seemed that way to me at age 10. I thought I could save them. I was banking on it. But then it fell apart, and this is where it gets hazy. I know I invented some stories to protect myself, but now I can't exactly remember which ones. And my parents couldn't help. So I decided to embark on a search for the truth about my past. Even though it had been 25 years, I figured, what the hell, I'd contact the members of that first cast of Zoom.
You know, I continued to be recognized up till my, I think, third year in college. I was registering at NYU, and you know, I was stopped at the front door by someone who recognized me.
That's John. I called him up in New York, where he's a playwright now, and approaching middle age, like all of us. This is him 25 years ago.
She cannot read. She cannot write, but she can smoke her father's pipe. She asked her mother.
I thought John could shed some light on my history, because he was part of the reason, at least as I remember it, that Chris, the producer, cut me from the cast.
And then Chris Sarson told me, I'm afraid we've decided internally that we need to add another girl to the cast.
Oh.
And there's too many. We had 5 boys and 2 girls, Nina and Nancy.
Yeah.
And what Chris told me was that you and John are both sort of little song and dance men.
Ah.
And so we've just sort of arbitrarily decided that John would work out better than you.
I can't believe they said that. Uh-huh. I cannot believe they said that.
And
oh, my God.
And then said to me, but, we're going to roll the cast over in a few months and bring in new kids, and we would like you to be involved then.
Wow.
But my recollection is that I turned down the opportunity to be on the second cast out of youthful hubris. That,
really?
I felt so humiliated.
Oh, man.
So
so like you can title this piece, like, Misery.
Well, I think I felt like, you know, I had my shot, I blew it, I'm no good,
oh, man.
Why bother?
Yeah, all at age 10. Your life is over at age 10.
John was sympathetic, and I appreciated that, but he didn't remember any of this incident, and no reason he should, I suppose.
Why don't you go ahead and open up the package I gave you?
All right.
He and I were in different studios for this interview, and I had sent him a photo that he opened while we were talking on the phone to see if he even remembered me.
Oh, oh my goodness, wow. Oh, look how little we are, holy smokes. Now this really brings back how young we were. Oh, now this is you with the blonde hair?
Yeah.
Oh man.
Does it ring any bell whatsoever?
In your suit.
I'll take that as a no.
Yeah, it really, I feel I'm embarrassed.
That's all right.
It's you look like you're a really cute kid. You should have been there. Oh my God.
I'm Joe. I'm Nina.
I'm Kenny.
My name's Tracy.
I'm Tommy.
We're listening to Dan Gettleman's story, I, Danny, Zoom Revisited, one of the stories which will be heard on the next edition of This American Life. We'll continue in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue with Dan Gettleman's story, I, Danny, Zoom Revisited, produced by Jay Allison. As we pick up the story, Dan's been visiting some of the original Zoom kids and asking them about their childhood as public television celebrities.
I still have paycheck stubs from back then. I saved them.
Next, I went to visit Joe, another kid from the first cast.
And all the publicity, I mean, God, must have been in every single newspaper in the United States. We were in Life magazine, Time magazine.
Just what I wanted to hear.
It was a great experience. It was an amazing experience. It's on my CV, you know. Absolutely. I put it on my CV now, you know, when I apply for jobs or as a psychiatrist, you know.
Now Joe is a child psychiatrist. Isn't that perfect? I remember Joe as a nice kid, very magnetic, thoughtful.
Well, I just remember you were blonde, and you were fun, and it seemed a good fit. And I was convinced that you were on the show. I think we all were. But, you know, I guess then we never got together after that, did we? Uh-huh.
No, we didn't. Not until now, all these years later. Talking to Joe, it was like I couldn't help myself, him being a psychiatrist and all. I began to confess.
All the kids in my school, I remember them making announcements over the PA system that I was on Zoom. And I was treated, you know, for a brief period of time from being rather a pariah to being a celebrity and then back again lower because the kids felt like I had, you know, lied or something. And the year after my whole Zoom deal was really rough. And since then, you know, I'm sure I went through a period where I told some fibs about my experience, if only because it was so humiliating in my mind to what really happened.
Right. You've obviously grown quite a bit. It's to your credit. You must have a good therapist. You know, I think that you actually, of everybody involved in Zoom, probably had the most unique experience, and I can see it as a really devastating experience.
Listen, he's treating me.
I mean, there you are. You're given the prize, and then you say, I'm sorry, you're disqualified. This is tough for anybody, but especially at that age. I mean, your whole self-esteem is mixed into this. You know, there you are. Are you good? Aren't you good? Are you talented? Aren't you talented? What is this? You know, I'm not the right sex. If I was a girl, I would be able to do this, you know? So I think, you know, I don't envy your position. This is a tough position to be in. It's a tough experience to have had.
Joe told me that maybe I've been recreating this past in my relationships, where I might be loved by someone, but I'm always thinking that they could change and decide, no, I don't want to love you. And I told him about how I had one set of memories in which I was the one who told Zoom that I didn't want to be a part of it.
My guess is if you created this memory where you blew off Zoom instead of the other way around, you might have been just a tad on the angry side, don't you think? Just a little annoyed by this whole event. But it's an incredible experience that you had. And, you know, that needs to be cherished. It is unique. You know, I didn't have that, you know, thank God.
Listen, I know time is up. I had two things I was hoping to do before I walked out the door, mm-hmm. One of which you're not asked this very often. I'm wondering if you could autograph your picture here. I'm going to ask Tommy to do the same.
Listen to me. I'm getting his autograph. Why? Because he's famous. He's Joe, the Zoom kid.
Well, I mostly remember speaking to you on the phone, like often during that period, I guess, and you were kind of wisecracking, kind of show-busy kind of person that I seemed to get along with pretty well, as I do gravitate towards showbiz phonies, even now.
That's Tommy, another Zoomer from the first cast. He was actually my best friend of that group. We talked all the time on the phone while we were auditioning for the
Joe
show.
Good part, though.
Include a stamp.
So we can drop you
a card. Then dip your note in a bucket of lard.
Yeah.
And then Nancy came in.
Yeah. So Joe doesn't know what he's talking about. You put it in an envelope without a doubt.
And then everybody came in.
No, then take your typewriter, pencil, or pen. If you make a mistake, you gotta do it again.
I got a real kick out of reminiscing like this. It made me feel like I was still part of things somehow. Tommy really tried to make me feel better. He called me the Pete Best of Zoom, which didn't really help that much, but I knew his heart was in the right place. But what I wanted to know from him was it great being a Zoom kid? What did I miss? Was it great being famous?
Well, I'm sure that the fame must have went to my head because you get so many people walking around kissing your ass and telling you how great you are. And just the fact that you're on TV, people look up to you. It's just the fact that you're on TV is always like the one of the biggest things you can do in America. It doesn't matter what kind of other achievements you can get.
Tommy and some of the others from that first Zoom cast went on to try to make it big. They did a commercial TV show and a record, but nothing really panned out.
Our parents kind of kept the ball rolling, and we got like a lounge band and, you know, tried to play live. And then, you know, things just kind of started fizzling. You know, when things start fizzling down, they fizzle down pretty quick.
Tommy's a video cameraman now. He loves the work, but he still wants to be a rock star. In fact, he gave me a compilation tape of all the bands he's been in over the years, hoping I might use it on this show.
The long-term effects of this on you, you know, when looking back now, you're 39, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's been 25 years. How has
being a Zoom kid affected you long term? It created my dream to work in this business. A dream that I pursue to this day. So it was a very heavy influence.
It's hard to live up to it sometimes. You're really hard pressed to come up with something that's a better, well-known achievement than that. I don't care how many degrees you have, how good you are, or how smart you are. If you're on Zoom, that's what people know you from. So I'll just accept that fact and move on.
Kind of depressing. I confess it made me feel a little better, though. When I got home from talking to Tommy, I listened to his tape. We're gonna play fast and we're gonna play loud. We'll do anything just to please the crowd. Wow,
Three-go-rock. Once you've done it, it debunks the mystique. You know, because in real life terms, what it meant was you really couldn't walk down the street without being recognized in some way or scrutinized.
This is John again.
There were certain events that were sort of traumatizing, like being mobbed, when a year ago you could go to the mall and just buy your shoes or whatever. Yeah, I'm with friends and suddenly, hey, there's John. And then three people come in. Of course, will you sign? And then someone decides, oh, it's a good idea to get an autograph. And suddenly you can't move because there were what seems like a multitude. Who knows? Probably it was 20 people. They're demanding your time. They're grabbing your arm. I found it incredibly unpleasant because they were looking at me and not seeing me. They were seeing some sort of image, and it was a sort of a glazy look, you know, of excitement and unreality.
This kind of helped, hearing this. I began to wonder if maybe I missed something that wasn't so great after all, whether I wasted a lot of time wishing I was on the show, even pretending sometimes that I was.
We're previewing the documentary I, Danny, Zoom Revisited with reporter Dan Gettiman. You can hear an expanded version of this story on the next edition of This American Life. The documentary was produced by Jay Allison as part of his series, Life Stories. I, Danny, Zoom Revisited will continue in the second half of our program. This is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue with the documentary I, Danny, Zoom Revisited. Also, Other People's Dirt. We talk with writer and house cleaner Louise Rafkin. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the music of clarinetist Ben Goldberg. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Let's continue with I, Danny, Zoom Revisited, a documentary with reporter Dan Gettleman and produced by Jay Allison. It's a preview from the next edition of This American Life, a show which will explore the theme of truth and lies at age 10.
You know what? I want to ask you a question.
All right.
I want to ask you, if it was true, were you ever really going to be on Zoom?
Yes.
I called up Karen. She had nothing to do with Zoom. She just watched it. But she was one of my closest friends during that time.
I've come to distrust some of my own memories and wonder whether, you know, how much of it is was wishful thinking, how much of it was, you know, fantasy or dreams or aspirations, and or what I told people as sort of a cover story.
I guess I should get back to my lie. In the spirit of full disclosure, here's exactly what my lie was. I let people believe that I, Dan Gettleman, was Danny, the Danny, the real Danny, on Zoom.
Was there a kid on the show named Danny?
Yes.
Do I remember that right? Yeah. And I remember trying to make him be you, because I wanted you to be on that show so much. I thought, well, maybe that's Danny. Maybe he just looks very different on television. Sounds different.
He was actually in the second cast. I didn't really intend to impersonate him or anything, but some of the time I would just kind of go with it, you know, and say, yeah, I was Danny, which, you know, technically speaking was true. And and they would get all excited and think that they were with a celebrity. So I did get some mileage out of that.
Oh, I was totally impressed.
This is my friend, Angela.
Yeah, I couldn't believe I knew somebody who'd actually been on Zoom. It would be like knowing, you know, the guy who did Oscar the Grouch or something. But then I was very sorry to hear that you were kicked off. I think you would have made a fine Zoomer. Actually, I know what my response was. My response was, you weren't Danny, were you? That's what it was. Now, if that had been the case, I don't know what I would have done.
If
you'd really been Danny, it would probably be almost like, not quite, well, it wouldn't exactly be like meeting Donny Osmond, but, you know, it would have been up there, I would say. Yeah.
So you were disappointed when you found out?
Well, I wasn't disappointed, but, you know, it was a nice little thought there for a moment that maybe you might have actually been him.
You know, I think everyone I talked to really wanted to make me feel better. It's okay that you weren't the real Danny. You're a perfectly good Danny. By the way, do you know the real Danny? I called him up.
Come on and zoom, come on and zoom, zoom, come on and zoom, come on and zoom, zoom. How's that?
That sounds great.
Thanks.
Great
song.
I have spent almost 25 years since my own involvement briefly with Zoom being mistaken for you.
No.
My name is Danny. You've never seen me, but I have, when I was the age, we're about the same age, and I had long blonde hair down to my shoulders, thick Boston accent, it's gone now, and we actually resembled each other a little bit.
Wow.
So as my teen years progressed, I would meet somebody, often a member of the opposite sex, and I would start to tell them the story of how I almost got on Zoom. And they would look at me, and they would kind of size me up, and they'd say, "You're Danny. I remember you. You're Danny."
That's funny.
And I have to be honest with you. I did not always correct them.
That's great. That's funny.
Okay, I confessed. I'll skip over this part, but basically, Danny was nice about it. Maybe a little embarrassed for me, maybe a little flattered. Like Tommy, he sent me a tape of the band he's in, just in case I wanted to use it in this show. Here it is, by the way. One last chance, last chance. I told Danny about my friend Angela and how she was in love with him, second only to Donny Osmond, and he was flattered by that. So I asked him a favor, to say hi to her, to give her kind of a radio autograph.
If we could take 15 seconds, you would make this woman's day. She's now, you know, in her early 30s. And just send a message out there to Angela.
Hi, Angela. This is Danny from Zoom. And I heard you are my biggest fan. It's great to get an opportunity to thank you for watching Zoom and being a fan of mine. That means a lot to me. And I do get around. If you're ever up in the Boston area, look me up and it'd be great to get together and say hi in person. Take care and best of luck to you.
See how his voice sounds? He knows he's the real Danny, that he can improvise a long paragraph like that to a complete stranger, a stranger who he assumes would want to look him up if they ever came to town. And in fact, he's probably right. He did it. He was a Zoomer. It's part of him. Like Joe the psychiatrist says.
It satisfied a very important part of my life, you know, that sense of having had that fame, having had that sense of being somebody special. I don't need to do that anymore. It's nice. I just got to go on.
Do you remember me at all?
Oh, sure. I don't remember your audition, and I don't remember, although I certainly hope when I open the envelope I'll get a chance to see your face.
Ground zero of my search. Chris Sarson, the producer who rejected me. He's sitting in a studio in Boulder, Colorado, and I'm in a studio in Kentucky.
Why don't you go ahead and open up the envelope I sent you and see if this does any good to jog your memory.
Open it.
This was awkward.
It's like Christmas. Christmas revisited.
I kind of put him on the spot.
Good heavens. I remember you much better now.
As I suspected, he didn't really remember who I was, but he was nice about it.
It's a picture of presumably you. It doesn't have a... Oh, wait a minute. It's a note. This is me, Kirk.
Obviously, this moment was a lot bigger in my life than in his.
Well, let me tell you what I recall of what happened and how I came to not be picked for the cast, etc. And tell me if this sounds plausible.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm blushing already. I wish we'd picked you.
Well, you know, what can you do? This is what I recall.
So I told him what I remembered, and he thought my memory was probably right, but he wasn't sure. And by this time, I've realized it doesn't matter much anyway, and that's incredibly liberating.
Correct me if I'm wrong, nobody really went on to a major showbiz career.
Well, I think it's lovely where the kids did end up.
Chris told me about the other cast members. Most of them went on to lead a variety of perfectly ordinary lives. None are big stars. One sings with a symphony. There are teachers, doctors, musicians. One was homeless for a while, and some reported having trouble in the aftermath of their brief fame on Zoom.
They were profoundly embarrassed that they'd been on that kid show, you know. And one guy said that it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years ago that he was able to get out and finally admit without shame that he was on the Zoom cast. So it may not have been all rosy if you'd got on the show, Dan.
Okay, I understand that now. I really do. Chances are it wouldn't have changed my life. But still, I'd take it. That special time, that attention. When all is said and done, I'd take my chances. I'd rather be a Zoom kid than just a kid. Wouldn't you? But it's okay. I'm still in the game. I write songs now. As a matter of fact, that's me singing one of my original tunes in the background. And I'd like you to know that my tape is available, by the way.
Braces and the car is needing struts. Now top of them, the dog is getting flayed.
The name is Dan Gettyman, not Danny.
Though we're getting older and our hair is turning gray, will I still remember Highwayman just like it's yesterday? How I wanted you in every way. Well, I began to fall in love right before your very eyes, and I knew I was a goner from the start. You had taken some possession.
Dan Gettyman's story, I, Danny, Zoom Revisited, was produced by Jay Allison as part of his ongoing series, Life Stories, and will be heard on the next edition of This American Life, a Public Radio International program produced at WBEZ in Chicago. The crew at This American Life are cooking up a show as we speak, exploring the theme of truth and lies at age 10. Our thanks to This American Life host and producer, Ira Glass. If you'd like to find out more about This American Life, you can check out their website at www.thislife.org. Dan Gettyman's CD is available at 1-800-BUY-MY-CD. Funds for Life Stories comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. Last but not least, this is Fresh Air. Louise Rafkin has a unique perspective on other people's private lives. For years, she's cleaned houses in the Cape Cod area, among other places, and is privy to the secrets and dramas that are normally hidden from public view. She knows when a couple she works for is having marital difficulties or when they have sex, how much money someone makes, who is dying, and who is on a diet. She writes in her book, Other People's Dirt, "I don't read diaries, but I do read clues. I see things and I hear things." Rafkin, who now teaches creative writing at Antioch University in Los Angeles, says she never set out to be a house cleaner. In fact, after getting her master's degree, she was determined to be a writer until she got a dose of reality, the difficulties of making a living on a writer's salary.
Everyone has a part-time job, I know, that's a writer, practically. And I can't spell, and I'm not a particularly good typist, so that was out. And I was in a situation where I had these skills. People kept wanting them. So there I was, in the houses alone, putting together stories in my head.
Well, you write about the fact that you grew up in a very neat house.
Yes.
That you're, I mean, really a neat house.
Yeah.
Describe it for us.
Well, my father sorted his golf balls. I didn't realize how odd that was until I sort of grew up and got out into the world. But he had, you know, he was an avid golfer, and he had them sorted by soil, degree of soil on them, or degree of mess up, or whatever they are in golf balls language. And there were, you know, sort of 12 little shoeboxes lined up. And my mother, you know, did the wash every day. She had a very particular regime about the house, which she still has.
Right. Was this one of those 50-style houses?
Ranch house families? In California, 3-bedroom, right. You know, the whole thing. My brother did the trash. I did the bathrooms, the gender-specific tasks that we were assigned.
One of your first jobs was cleaning villas in the French Riviera, part of a kind of a cleanup crew that would come in after rentals. Is there something cultural about dirt and cleanliness and neatness?
What I found over there? No, I actually say in the book that, you know, to echo Gertrude Stein, a toilet is a toilet is a toilet. You know, there's certain people that are certain ways, but I've cleaned in several countries on several continents, and it's basically the same work. You know, and I ended up in Japan in the book, and that was very interesting. I lived with the people who clean as a spiritual practice.
Yeah, tell us more about that, because I found that fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, really combining Zen philosophy and this idea of which actually made sense to me by the time I finished the chapter, but this idea of cleaning and the Zenness of it all.
Yeah, it was very challenging to me. I had thought, you know, myself quite evolved spiritually, and then I got to the point where these people for their entire life have no private money or things, and they give them their service as a way of being thankful for being alive. And it was founded on the basis of a businessman in the 20s who was very disgusted by capitalism, actually, and the amassing of things. So, you know, I was there the same week that a group of Mr. Donut workers were being trained in this humbling philosophy. They went out every day and knocked on doors and said, I'm here to serve you for the humble practice of toilet cleaning. And I was very moved by it, mm-hmm. but certainly challenged.
Were you humbled?
I was humbled one day, particularly when I had spent the entire day sweeping the forest outside the grounds of the compound, and felt sort of proud and accomplished about the day's work. But no one had seen my work that day. And it was sort of 5-6 o'clock, and the wind came up, and the whole place was decimated with leaves. And I just spontaneously burst into tears because I realized I was very attached to the idea of getting something, being a good girl, being a good Girl Scout, getting a big check, whatever it was.
The pat on the head.
Yeah, and no one had seen it. And you know, I thought, this is what these people do their entire life. Mm. No one sees it. They're very humble people.
Could you translate that humility to this country when you were doing your work and feeling that sense of oneness, you know, that Zen sense of oneness with the toilet you're cleaning?
Well, I do get a particularly good sense of finishing a job and having a job well done. But I think what I translated, the most recent thing that happened to me is that I moved into a new neighborhood and someone across the street had moved in and had a new party and left all their trash on the street. And for about a day, I complained to all my friends about it. Oh, these new neighbors, they're going to leave all the chicken bones and, you know, I can't believe it. And then, you know, it suddenly flashed on me, my experience in Japan, and I got up the next day, went out in my pajamas, cleaned the thing up. It took 15 minutes. Mm. And I had this sense of, in this culture, we don't clean unless it's ours. You know, we just sweep it under the rug, or we complain, or we bury it in the Nevada desert, or we hope it goes away. But it's really hard to take responsibility for the world, and that's sort of where we are in a way, you know.
That's the difference, too, between service and servitude, because I think reading through this and as one thinks about someone that cleans one's house or another person's house, there's that awkward sense that you're the, you know, you're the owner and they are somehow serving you. But reading through this, it seems that the many of the house cleaners don't have that attitude at all. Have their own sense of empowerment.
Exactly. I mean, I was very interested. I spent a month in New York cleaning up with different people from different cultures. And not only were they bankers and librarians in their own country before they were swept out of there, but they had a sense of, you know, I'm doing this and I feel okay about myself. And particularly the chapter that I interview a woman who cleaned up after the Kennedys and the Fricks and the Hearst and 91 years old, spent her entire life in service to the big houses. She had actually adopted very upper class values as a way, I think, of buffering herself from that idea of I'm not someone and they are someone. She was very interesting.
Yeah, and I'm not here to serve you. I mean, I think people that wait on tables wrestle with this same relationship with someone where you're giving them something that they, in a sense, could get themselves if they were home, but somehow you're serving them.
Right, and also that they're invisible in a certain way. You know, there were a lot of cleaners who told me, you know, that was sort of the joke. All they know is my price and my phone number, and I know everything about them. So who's got the power in that relationship, you know? And it's upset people. There's a few people that have read my book and said, you know, I'm very upset about the idea that you had a job and you weren't supposed to talk. And I thought to myself, there's not a Hippocratic oath for cleaners, and I'm not really paid not to talk.
Right.
I mean, I don't feel like I was mean to anyone, but the idea that we don't see anything by virtue of $40 or $50 or $60 a week is not enough, you know.
The way you write about a house, you can literally walk into it and you know if it's a happy house, if someone has died, if there's some tragedy, if people are working on a divorce, it all seems to be right there.
It's very evident. In fact, one of the couples in my book got divorced over the course of me working with them, and it was very upsetting because you saw everything move from the shared bathroom and bedroom to the other bathroom and bedroom, and there was a little note by the door that said, "It's all yours." And, you know, the pictures started disappearing from the desktops of each other's on their desks. And, you know, it was sort of hard to go there because you saw it, you know.
Is there a part of the house you think that gives someone away, or a piece of furniture, or the way someone will pile their stuff on furniture that is most revealing about a person?
Well, I think there's certain sites. I don't think it's one, but there's the bathroom, the medicine cabinet, the bedside table, the refrigerator, and the reading matter. Of course, I always like to see what they're reading as a literature major. And I would talk to them about their books, but, you know, how many times? You'd go, oh, is it Danielle Steeler? Oh, my gosh, they're reading the new Reynolds Prize. You know, it's like it's a
kindred spirit.
Yeah,
there,
yeah. Right? Then you'd be sort of excited.
Leave a note saying, don't forget to...
or this is a really good one. This is my other favorite one. I would often leave literary recommendations.
Yeah. But did you like the invisibility? Because you also write about being in the house when the person who owns the house is there, and that awkwardness of perhaps breaking that invisibility, that they know you're there, you know they're there, and somehow the territory shifts.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's always easier not to have someone at home, I think. You know, even though you want to meet them. And several jobs that I had for maybe 8 years, I met the people 3 or 4 times over that time.
There was actually a moment, a really touching moment in your book when an older couple, and the wife was ill, and you and the husband made the bed together.
I know.
And it was really just a very sweet moment and a tender moment, and also poignant because the enormity of what he was dealing with, what you both were dealing with, but specifically what he was dealing with.
I know there are some, I call them fairy tale moments in a house cleaner's life. There were some beautiful moments that I had with that one particularly. I mean, you don't find yourself making a bed with someone else's husband very often in your life, and looking across the bed and realizing what's going on. And then there was, you know, a moment where I was side by side at the sink with a sort of a quite famous screenwriter, and he was all thrilled about, you know, getting the rust stains off his sink. And it was a great moment. Like, we were laughing, and there we were from quite different worlds, and, you know, sharing this thing. So you have these fairy tale moments, I think, and they are quite sweet. And, you know, it's an intimate relationship.
Louise Rafkin writes and cleans houses in San Francisco. Her book is Other People's Dirt. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
1998 was a high-profile year for the Oakland-based clarinetist Ben Goldberg, who has four current CDs out on as many labels. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews three of them.
That's clarinetist Ben Goldberg's sextet on his new CD, 12 Minor, where his klezmer roots are easy to spot. The players come mostly from the Bay Area improviser scene, where Goldberg is a mainstay. Still, here and elsewhere, he often curtails his improvisers' options. With a group this size, he's a sort of traffic cop, recombining his players to keep the colors changing. He specifically seeks to avoid the sort of unfocused improvising where the players ignore the thematic material and much of it winds up sounding the same. Goldberg also has two CDs of trio music out now, different bands playing music organized in very different ways. Clarinetist Ben Goldberg and two more Bay Area regulars, bassist Trevor Dunn and drummer Elliot Humberto Cavi. Their CD, Here By Now, is on the Music and Arts label. For this session, Goldberg told the musicians, no improvising, just play the song. Meaning, don't use the melody as a springboard to your own stuff, but stay focused on the tune in your own way. That's not so different from what we heard his sextet do a minute ago, or for that matter, from what Art Tatum did in the 1930s or Ornette Coleman in the 50s. The musicians still have lots of interpretive leeway. How well it works depends on how well the tunes engage them and us. I really like Ben Goldberg's clean, dry clarinet sound. If the premise behind that music is basically simple, just play the melody, he takes a more complex approach with his other trio. You've heard of 12-tone music, this is sort of 4-tone music. The pieces take off from 4 notes apiece, which Goldberg and guitarist John Schott juggle and mutate according to preset rules. That must sound terribly artificial to some folks. In practice, it makes the improvising sound that much more unified and organic, because each always has a good idea where the other is going. So does the drummer, a ringer from New York, and well worth sending out for, Michael Serene. That's from the trio CD, What Comes Before, on the Sodic label. One impressive thing about the current deluge of Ben Goldberg CDs is, for all their procedural and sonic variety, they still sound like the product of one mind, for for reasons that go beyond a distinctive clarinet style. All this music has one quality in common. Call it soul.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the new book, New Dutch Swing. Ben Goldberg's other CD is Eight Phrases for Jefferson Rubin. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.